Okay, welcome everybody. Nothing like running right in. So thank you, Rabbi Eli Rubin, for each and every time. He has a very busy schedule and is always willing to contribute. We're going to be off the next 2 weeks, then stay tuned. So without further ado, Rabbi Eli Rubin.
Thank you. So you'll need some chumashim just for reference, but we'll explain what needs to be explained. So it's okay if you don't have one. I'm sorry, I thought I brought into the number of people we have, but I didn't expect one and two. All right, here's the handout. So I interdispersed English in translations of Hebrew, not knowing what the learners would prefer, so you have both options here. But not for each commentary. So I was thinking about, as just a way of introduction to this class, is that sometimes you have an idea and then you can find the theme in the Chumash, and sometimes you have a theme in the Chumash and you try to attach an idea to it. Sometimes current events, you can read into words of the Chumash, and sometimes current events makes you read into words of the Chumash. So I'm going to really just avoid, like I normally do, any current events or any political or personal feelings about any controversial issue.
Again, yes, right.
But on the other hand, you'll see that this topic, I think, is very relevant, and it shouts from the words, and the text is really very animated once you begin to spotlight and analyze some of the psukim, and it's certainly through the perspective of the most conventional of all mefarshim, Rashi and Ramban. So we're really not going too far this time to try to find interpretations and explanations. We're really going for the conventional, but you'll see, I think that it really is a very interesting perspective. Just as a second way of introduction, the Parsha Vayechi, it's called Satum. So for those who are not readers from the actual Torah itself, every parsha has some break, or most parshiot have some break between the words, or at most a paragraph. Even sometimes even in the one sentence there could be some parshiot words. This parsha is unique, is that Vayechi begins literally right after the end of the pasuk of Vayigash. So this is the way it looks like in the Torah. Then it's called Parshat Satum or Parshat Stuma. So the Farshim are going to ask and start speaking about why is Vayechi so different that it didn't really start with the conventional way the Torah opens.
How do you know the Parsha starts right there?
Vayechi, the first word Vayechi.
No, but why is that?
Oh, this is Mesorah. Prakim or not? That's not. We didn't design the Prakim, but the actual Parshat themselves are by the Mesorah. That's why the question is a viable question. You're right. If it's just by chance that these are the parshiot randomly, then it wouldn't make any difference. Wouldn't have any insight to ask a question about why it's starting that way. So if you take a look at the first Rashi, I have it in Hebrew, in English. If you want to look at it in the Rashi Hebrew text while I read it to you in English, it's a little bit inconsistent with language that we're going to be used to explicate this concept. And Rashi and Jacob lived the first Vayechi Yaakov. The first Rashi in our Parsha. Why is this Sidra totally closed by Chiyakov? Because compromising it does an account of the death of Jacob. As soon as our father Jacob departed this life, the hearts and eyes of Israel were closed. In other words, in parenthetically, their eyes became dim and their hearts troubled because of the misery of the bondage which they began to impose upon him. So it's almost as if that the Torah is giving us a homiletic introduction into the Parsha of Yechi, which is going to open the door into Shemot, that as Yaakov dies, the bondage or the Shibud of Mitzrayim begins. So the Mizrahi and the Maral both ask the same question. I only copied here the Mizrahi, who is one of the super commentators in Rashi, and I wrote a slash next to it, Maral. These are not the words of the Maral, but it's the same exact idea. So just for purposes of saving ink and paper, I didn't see any real value in copying the Maral, since the ideas are almost identical. So the Mizrahi asks the following question. He says, Va'afal pishi Yosef chai, achar p'tirat Yaakov nun dalet shana, Yosef lived 54 years. V'yev shalash shabdam b'chayav she'a Moshe b'choyot tzitzrayim. And we know that nobody would dare enslave the Jews while yet Yosef was still alive. And still shvatim kayam lo hetchil shabdam yesh lomar. The reason why the Torah starts with Vayechi in such a cryptic way that there is no space between Parsha and Vayigash, shelo yashibud mamash, it didn't really actually begin. It started slowly. It was a slow, creeping shiabud, an enslavement that the Jewish people didn't really see, or if they saw it, they weren't really sensitive to it. So by Yechi Yaakov Eretz Yisrael, as Yaakov died, all of a sudden there was a shift attitudinally with the relationships they had with the Egyptians. Perhaps they sensed it, perhaps they didn't, but that's why the Parsha is Satuma, or Parsha is Satum. So in the beginning, Eladerech Bakashau Pius, Kemoshan Betchila Beferach. In the beginning, it was part of just, they were cajoling and convincing the Jewish people to take a different economic state within Egypt. Loya Chosef Lemono, it happened very gradually. And the Jews were doing this, and they were almost abiding by all the new regulations and new rules because they were showing respect to the king. So as the rules began to slowly, incrementally build against the case of Jews, the Jews silently followed along, thinking that was their national duty to follow the new edicts and the new decrees, although it didn't necessarily feel right. They knew as good citizens of guests in a foreign land, that was the only choice they had. As I said, there's a lot of subtleties here. To an intelligent group, I don't need to spell out and explicitly direct us towards both our history, past, and maybe present. That's what I want to try to avoid, but certainly let the reader take from the message that is most relevant and resonant with you. So I particularly like the word that they were trying to show, laharot chibatan lemelech, that they were trying to demonstrate their loyalty to the king, and therefore accepted willingly the new laws that were being implemented. Elishima yukoza yisrael mitzarim alapol, if they were really going to enslave them, they would never have done it. In other words, had they seen the end unfold and they had a crystal ball, or if the rules, the initial rules, would have been very draconian or very extreme, they would have never agreed to it. And they knew that one day there would be a shiabud, so therefore they went in a very gradual, slow process that went almost undetected. I once heard an interesting comparison of anti-Semitism to cooking a lobster. Okay, you heard this one before? Not that I know anything really about lobster.
It's that guy who runs a comedy in Israel.
Oh, is that where it came from? Oh, it came from Dry Bones?
I heard from him at Stern.
Oh, really? I don't remember the original source. You don't throw a lobster into boiling water, because if you throw a lobster into boiling water, the lobster would climb out. So a way to cook a lobster, for people who are not lobster eaters, is you throw a lobster into cold water. The lobster feels very comfortable. You start turning up the heat a little bit more until it gets a little warm. The lobster just thinks, okay, the temperature is changing, it's climate change, and before the lobster knows it, he's boiled to death. So this is really, it's the lobster approach to the Shibud of Mitzrayim, which brings us back to the first question, is why did the Parsha begin? Why did the Parsha begin with a closed by Yigash Vayechi? Because as Yaakov died, the attitudes changed. The Jews didn't feel it. As you can even say that their eyes, if you look in the original Rashi, is that, you know, I kind of struggled with Rashi's words. If you use it more in a, if you offer a close reading of Rashi, Nistimu Einehem. If you take a look at the words of Rashi, and now I think I understand what it means their eyes were closed. It wasn't that they were closed out of pain and they weren't suffering. Their eyes were closed to see the reality, and they expected to see a reality that they dressed into, or they read into what they saw, without really reading without interpreting it correctly. One of your sheets may have some of my notes on it, so if you see it, just tell me.
There you go.
Yeah, okay, thanks. There's nothing really very profound on it. It's just a kind of like markers for me. Thank you. It's not like you have the teacher's edition. Yeah, right. Sorry, I'm taking nothing from you. It's just giving me direction. They're kind of like prompts. If you go after that Mizrahi, the Maral, which again, if you want to just take underline any word in this, and it's not shamos, you know, there's nothing shame Hashem. You can do whatever you want with this page. La rot chibatan lamelech. That's it, to show their loyalty to the king. How many books and how many pieces of history have we read through Jewish history that Jews were trying to show that they were good, loyal citizens and they would never betray the culture of the country because that was they understood that their citizenship was precarious. We're going to see much more of this. I'm not done. Klei Yakar. So let's go back to the end of Parshat Vayigash, the last few words of Vayigash. Take a look at the Pasuk Kav Zayin. Vayeshev Yisrael b'Yeretz Mitzrayim. So this is the end of Parshat Vayigash, page 266 in the Art Scroll. Vayeshev Yisrael b'Yeretz Mitzrayim b'Eretz Goshen. And we know after the Jews arrived in Goshen and they lived in the land of Mitzrayim, in the land of Goshen. Some question the order there. It's if you ever want to go into the exegesis of Vayigash, that's a question. To me, they created a positive ghetto. This is really the first ghetto they say is in Italy. The first ghetto is in Goshen. The difference between it was semi-imposed because if you remember, Yosef wanted them to live in Goshen and Paro wanted them to be in Goshen. Again, it didn't have that same type of discrimination, but it certainly had the same effect without the walls. We're going to come back to that all the way at the end if we have time. And they held on to it with, they acquired property in it, and they were fruitful and multiplied greatly. In other words, it goes from they lived in the Goshen to they started acquiring real estate in Goshen. So that's a word that gets completely lost. So the Klei Yakar picks up on this. The Klei Yakar in last week's parsha, I'm going to go back and forth. Ha-pasuk mashimam al yeshiva zu shebikshu achuza be'eretz lo lehem. They were supposed to be temporary sojourners, guests of the land of Egypt. Only until the famine would conclude. Instead, they purchased land because the real estate acquisition demonstrated their commitment to a longer residence, or maybe even a permanent residence, in a land that was never determined to be theirs from the beginning. Lo kach amru el Paro. They never said this to Paro when they first got there. They said to Paro in the Klei Yakar quotes, Lagur be'eretz banu. We're only here temporarily. And we say this in the Haggadah also. This is now a quote from Haggadah. They never had intention of settling the land as permanent residence. And now they recanted as if they went back on their original narrative. They became so comfortable that even in the end, when we were redeemed, we know from the Medrash that there were those who never wanted to leave Egypt, it became their home. So the Klei Yakar, it almost is in a, I wouldn't say parallel, but they're certainly thematically very consistent. The Klei Yakar at the end of Vayigash says that Jewish people took Mitzrayim as their home. Yaakov was still alive, and if you take it from that sequence, Yaakov dies. They feel as if, okay, the winds of culture are changing, but this is our land, we have our real estate here, we have our home, nothing will happen to us. I have medals from World War I. I fought for this country, I lived in this country, my grandparents lived in this country, certainly we're safe as anyone could be. That's about as close as I'm going to get to drawing parallels to history, but it will be difficult for me to contain myself from time to time. So Rashi and Klei Yakar are consistent, and this continues. Now the next source here, I guess I could have found the English for it, so if you're not that comfortable in Hebrew, I'll certainly translate it, but it kind of loses a little in translation. And now we're going to go back to Vayechi. So this is one of the few times in Chumash that the Ramban doesn't start with a normal or the normative way of interpreting words and concepts. And he just starts off with an introduction. We know the Ramban gives very important introductions to each of the five books. Here he gives an introduction to the Parsha Vayechi. There is nothing that he's commenting on other than his observation from 30,000 feet. So he writes, I'm going to skip the first part. I read that Yaakov was the beginning. Why did Yaakov go down? They had no food. There was a famine. They thought they would be saved there. Yosef was was their protector, their facilitator. They thought they would leave at the end of the famine and they would return back to Eretz Canaan. Now we're going to pick it up at the bottom of the page, where it says, Aval Arach Aleim HaGalut. It's the last sentence on that page. And Arach is with an Aleph. Aval Arach Aleim HaGalut. Umeit Sham. And Yaakov extended his residence in Egypt. We know he did, because we know he lived there 17 years. and the Rav was only going to be 7 years, the famine. So we know that Yaakov was complicit in this idea of staying in the in this new comfortable diaspora. Avo arach aleim aglut umeitsham, and he died there. V'alu atzmotav v'ziknei paro v'sarav he'eliu, and everybody brought up his bones. They took his remains and they brought it to Canaan. This is all recorded. This is not medrash. V'asuimo avel kaved, and they carried on with real sense of mourning. V'chein anachnu, and look, now the Ramban is adding his own commentary. V'chein anachnu romi v'edam. Achenu has sivunu biitanu biadam. We brought them into our land. Ki kartu britim aromim v'agripa samelach acharon lebayichini barach aleim lezra. The last king of the Jews in the time was Agrippus, who made a pact with the Romans, and that treaty was to protect them from outside invaders. And ultimately, we were surrounded by the Romans, who created a siege, and we were Yerushalayim was taken by the same allies that we reached out to create a protective agreement. And as a result of that agreement that Agrippus made with the Romans, it ultimately led to our demise. Lo no da kitzo. We don't know when this is going to end, this diaspora. Kasher ha-galiot v'anachnu bo kemitin. And we are like dying here outside the land of Israel. Now, just to worry about the Ramban, this is just, if we had time, I can elaborate on what I'll say. It certainly can have enough proof text to feel comfortable saying it. Ramban was a true lover of Yishuv Eretz Israel, of living in the land of Israel. Probably the original father of modern Zionism, as is interpreted by Rav Kook and many others. He laid the foundation, and we know that he ultimately moved to Israel after his debate with Pablo Cristiani, and there's a lot of letters that he sends to his son, and he certainly lived, although with difficulty, he lived his dream that we belong in the land of Israel. So it's not too much of a surprise when he said that we made this, we brought our own troubles on ourselves during the end of the Second Temple, the same way that Yaakov and Yosef brought on their troubles, because the same way that by making this agreement, this arrangement with Paro to find security, the same people we trusted to provide security and safety were the ones who ultimately turned on us, persecuted us, and then enslaved us, and to some degree even murdered us. So there's a really powerful comments that are being written in the 12, 1300s. And of course, Rashi lived through the Crusades, that period of time. Not a big surprise that he would sense some degree of persecution. Ramban, as I mentioned, certainly lived through degree of persecution, and the Klei Yarchi came much later. So the question whenever you read commentaries is, how much are commentaries like anyone else just reading into their own history, their own life narrative, and finding in the verses, or how much are the verses really screaming to be interpreted in that way? But it's certainly consistent. I'm going to stop here. Does anybody have any questions? Because we're going to continue now with other sources. Yes?
Just the Ramban is saying not to make treaties, but yet, like when Yoshiyahu
right,
didn't make a treaty with
right.
Didn't let Paro come through.
Correct. Well, they chose the wrong. Well, they chose the wrong Ben Brit.
Yeah.
That was with Yoshiyahu.
You can actually trace it even further to Chilas Yosef to the Tzai. Yadot edak kigeri zarchab elsel olahem.
Right.
Could have been in Syria.
Right.
You made it into the Tzai.
Right.
So
that's true.
We created that.
Right.
That's
true.
Could have been.
Good point. I don't think Ramban is trying to create just an unequivocal policy of Jews living Am Levadodishka, no treaties, no peace. I don't think Ramban is also giving us a directive on how we should live our lives nationally or locally. I think there is a degree of sensitivity about, you know, kind of like buyer beware, who's our partner, what are their interests, and anytime kind of you read in political history, interests shift. And they don't only shift against us, they shift against others. People, countries will act in their own national interest, and that's on a national, global scale. I think the more important is that we don't have the protection, and we're not a national entity like the Hashmonaim, but we are living as tribes, in countries that are not ours, and we have a sense of security that may be reinforced by past history. It doesn't mean that that past history is any indication of future security. And that's something which the Jewish people learned over and over again the hard way, and it's a question that we just should always ask ourselves. Now, I know I come from this perspective, and I'm probably leading you to it, but I'm not making it up. I mean, maybe somebody would have looked at this and come in a different way, but these are the words that the Ramban, the Kli Yarchan, and Rashi and others use. I've always been very interested in the history of and the manifestation of anti-Semitism, and so my wife actually put a moratorium on me reading any more books that have to do with doom and gloom. she really did. She took them away from me. So that was after I read Deborah Lipstadt's book, Anti-Semitism Here and Now. Barry Weiss has came out with recent books. I'm reading a book now called Return to the Reich, which is about a Jewish, it was reviewed in the Wall Street Journal, about a Jewish commando spy that returned to do undercover work. I said to my wife, look, it's not a book about the Holocaust. He goes, well, of course it's a book about the Holocaust, just for a different perspective. So it's time to move on. So I'm trying to listen to her, and that's why you're seeing informed in this. But I really think it resonates a lot if you look at the words. Now, go back to...
Does she know you're here doing this?
No, because I'm here, she has no idea what the subject is. She can probably guess, because I only know one subject. That's all I know. Go back to Perek Mem Hei. Interesting word, again, the Ramban. Mem Hei Pasuk Aleph. So now we know this is going back to Vayigash. I'm going to go back and forth a little. So the Ramban has an interesting observation. He says, Lo yachol Yosef l'hitapek. Yosef could not restrain himself any longer. When as he heard that these are his brothers, and they regretted their actions, they were sorry, they were remorseful, they were contrite. Yehuda took responsibility. It was everything he was waiting for came to be. It all was manifest at once. And it all came out with a gush of emotions. And they were frightened. They were humbled. So what does Yosef do? Take a look at Pasuk Aleph. Lo yachol Yosef l'hitapek l'chol anitzavim. He couldn't bear it anymore. Vayikra hotziu chol ish mi'alai. Remove everybody from this palace. Lo amad ish ito b'hitvada Yosef elachav. And no Egyptian was there when he confessed and admitted to his brothers, Ani Yosef, I am your brother Yosef. It's just a dramatic pasuk. We might as well just finish it, even though it's not really related. One of the greatest verses in Torah. But what the subtlety here is not what's explicit. What's explicit, we obviously see he was very emotional, and he let the brothers heal his kind of indirect wrath. But what was very subtle here is that he vayikra, and he called to the audience to leave. I don't know if you paid attention to that. Why would he ask them all to leave? Everybody noticed that every Egyptian had to leave the room. Anybody want to take a little bit of an insight? What would be the reason he asked everybody to leave when he admitted to his brothers that Ani Yosef Achi? So the Ramban picks up this question. It's okay if you don't have an answer. I don't know. Had I not seen the Ramban, I would have known. Once you see the Ramban, then you see why. Now, that was very apparent. But Tamba Yikra, you see what says Ramban? Says the second page. What is the reason why he called them all to leave? Shirim kolo bakas. He was angry. Now, how do you know he's angry? We don't. I think I mentioned in one of these classes that Dr. Fried gave me the privilege to teach is that the Chumel Leibowitz would say you have to read intonation into the verses, because otherwise you miss the interpretation of the verses if you don't have any intonation. So Ramban says this. Read it with anger. She'erim kolo bekas. Yamulim ishartab hotziu kolish milai bilti anashim eila. Everybody has to exit this room except for these spies. V'tam b'hotzah. And what was the reason he asked them to leave? He didn't want the Egyptians to hear about the demise of his family, that they sold him. How humiliating it is that they were sold their own brother. How debased, how immoral, how cruel. The game love of Michal. And it will be a future problem. She yomru avdei paro mitzrayim aleim elu anshei bogdot. these are traitors. These people coming down from Canaan, these are not civil-minded people who will uphold the laws and the culture of Egypt. These are people who are devious. They're not to be trusted. Lo yaguru baratzenu. Lo yidrachu ba'amanotenu. We won't even let them into our palaces. Bagdu ba'acheyem. If they betrayed their brother and their father, bagdu ma'yasu ba'melech ha'malon. They'll betray us. So what was Yosef, with all of his power, at the height, the apex, the zenith of his influence, what was he thinking? That the Egyptians won't trust us, and that they'll look at us as foreigners, not native, inorganic, that we're going to be people that will always be a fifth column. At this point of his life, you would think that he felt completely confident and bold and resolute about his place in Egypt. Even that moment when he was sitting on the throne, he felt that there was a threat of a Jewish culture in a clash with Egyptian culture. He knew instinctively, intuitively, that they were just not accepted as full citizens. Did you see that coming? Did you see that coming?
Right. I would think he felt shame also.
That could have been a very good answer. But it's not what the Ramban says.
I know, but I'm saying, yeah. I'm just putting myself on.
Yeah.
Ashamed that, you know.
They sold me. Yeah, what kind of a leech am I that I had to be sold?
But wasn't that...
Right?
That's a story by...
Sorry, Ruchem Acha.
Yeah, that they eventually the Goyim did.
Yeah, they used it. Yeah. Right, very good point. Thousands of years later. Yeah, the Ramban is not the only answer. You're right. It could have been just a very simple reason that it's very embarrassing. Here he was, the second most powerful person in the land of Egypt, and he was originally sold by his brothers. But the Ramban looks at it again, more of a geopolitical, national, anti-Semitic lens, that as a Jew living within Egypt, even in control, and if you look back at Jewish history, there were times when Jews had positions of power, and they were afraid to exercise it on behalf of their Jewish brethren because they felt it would look as if that they were showing more loyalty to their Jewish people than they were actually to their king. There's a line about Golda Meir and Henry Kissinger. That the line goes that Henry Kissinger said that I am an American first and a Jew. I'm an American Jew. So he says, that's very nice, Henry Kissinger. He says, in English you read from left to right, but in Hebrew we read right to left. And so I am true and not true, I'm not really sure, but it's certainly a pithy enough comment to recognize the tension that people felt in this position. Yosef didn't. Yosef never forgot who he was. And the Ramban, again, I think is very sensitive to it. Now take a look at the next one. I think I'll have to make sure.
Also look at it in a way that he's protecting him and them. Like
right. I think that's also another perfectly fine to say it. But I'm trying to develop a theme here based on the Ramban. Had I not started with this Ramban in Vayechi and Vayigash, because I knew that Ramban a little earlier, I don't know if I would have gotten to this theme drilling down. But once you start putting together the pieces, you really begin to see a story unfold that if you could pluck it out and highlight it and cherry pick it, there's some very interesting sub-theme going on here in Egypt. But I'm not done. Umiktecha. Take a look now at 47.2. So 47.2. Now going also in Vayigash. Mem Zayin Bet. 262. Thank you. Of course, it's the last page I can't open. Okay. Mem Zayin Bet. Okay. So Yosef comes with all his brothers. Vayabo Yosef Vayaged Lefaro Vayomer Avi Amaptaalt. I'm sorry. And they all coming together. He's telling Paro with a lot of trepidation. I was an Aleph. I'm sorry. I started with Aleph. A lot of trepidation and hesitation. And he was equivocating. He's standing in front of Paro with all of his power. He was still, knees were trembling. How do I know that I don't? I'm just kind of making that up. But Nachum Leibowitz said I can do that. Again, sometimes these little words in Chumash can go so lost in a quick laning. Not that I'm against quick laning, but it can get really lost. Look in Pasuk Bet in English. From the least of his brothers, he took five men and presented them to Paro. What does that mean, the least of his brothers? So you could say umikseh, however you want to. Again, any interpretation is fine. Rav Shavir said nobody owns Torahs. But this is just one way of looking at it. And take a look at the Rashi. I have the Rashi on your notes. And you can look at the Rashi. Umikseh achav. Rashi says, again, I'm not going too far. I'm going to some of the classic standard commentaries on Chumash. Min ha-pchutim shebehem l'gvura. They were the weakest physical ones. They didn't present as brave warriors. He would enlist them. He would take them. So there was this fear that we have to present ourselves as a little bit on the margins. You know, we're not really in mainstream. You can't put us into the middle. And if you take us where we are, then we're going to lose our identity. And we know at any moment that could happen. We could be taken up and swallowed up into the larger culture of Egypt. Had I interpreted this, and if I had permission to go a little bit more dark, I would say, based on Rashi, and that's not what he says, is that had he showed them the stronger brothers, he would have seen them as a threat.
Right.
Yeah. And Rashi doesn't say that.
That's
what Rashi said. He would see them as a threat. Yeah. Notice he wanted to show them the weak ones, say, don't worry, we're just shepherds. So we're not going to have any insurrections. Because later on in Shmot, we know that's what happened.
Well, but that's the opposite of Rashi saying, basically the opposite.
It's definitely not the same. You're right. But I think what Rashi is saying, though, is that Yosef was always fearful of the fact that we as a people don't have, if we don't hold on to our identity, we're going to lose our identity.
That's the theme of Israelite separations.
Right.
From Avram, not wanting to bury him.
Right.
Shimon Levi with Edina.
But what resonates with me here is that Yosef didn't have the power and the authority and the influence.
Or the confidence.
Or maybe the confidence to create a separate identity for himself and his brothers. It had to always be in a way that he didn't think it would attract attention or bring negative attention, or because he would think the second in command would have had it. And you're going to see where this plays out in a very interesting way. So now, I'm sorry to keep on back and forth. Now go to Perek Mem Zayin, verse 31. So it's Mem Zayin, Lamed Aleph. And whoever gets there first, scream out the page.
268.
Wow, that was really fast. Oh my, you were
so,
that was really very fast. Okay, right in the beginning of Vayechi. So we're back in Vayechi. Lest someone say to me that I don't know how to give a shir in Parshat Vayechi, only Parshat Vayigash. So I have some verses in Vayechi also, so I can be a legitimate Vayigash, Vayechi shir. But this class could have been Vayigash also, so it would have worked both ways. Take a look at the Pasuk, 47:31. Let's start with it's always good to start a pasuk earlier, but pasuk alam 30. So Yaakov is now talking. He says, "V'shachafti ma'avotai, I want to be buried with my father and grandfather. Una satani mimitzrayim, take me to Egypt. Take me out of mimitzrayim. Sorry, ukvartani b'kfuratam vayomar." And then Yosef says, "Anochi e'eseh chidvarecha." Okay. Yosef says to his father, "No worries, Dad. I got this one. We're going to bury you in Maarat HaMachpelah. You got my word on this." No, but that's not where it ends. "Vayomer hishavali. I need you to swear. Vayishavalo vayishtach Yisrael rosh hamita." And he said, "You need to swear that you're going to carry my bones and my remains back to Canaan." So again, reading it quickly, you say, okay, it was very dramatic. He wanted to make sure, wanted to be reassured. And you can come up, 100%, I would accept any interpretation on this verse. It doesn't mean that this interpretation is the only interpretation, the one that I'm about to introduce in the Ramban. But the Ramban's question is, what did he need to swear? Right? He didn't trust his own son. And his own son, who was the loyal son, his favorite son, and the son who had all the control and the authority and influence to take him out, he made him go through this drama of swearing and keeping the kitat chepetz. So take a look. This one is in English. "Swear to me," and he swore. Jacob was not suspecting that his righteous beloved son would defy his father's words, about which Joseph already promised, because he already said, "I'm going to do this. Anochi esech chidvarecha." Jacob did this in order to strengthen his position versus Pharaoh. Jacob knew. Now we're not talking about Yosef now. Jacob, look what he says. It's so interesting how sensitive Yaakov and Yosef were to the political vicissitudes of Jewish life in a foreign country. Look what he says. For he might have not given permission, Joseph, to depart. Maybe Pharaoh would never have given permission to Yosef to take him. And then Yosef would have been stuck. And he would have said, take your brothers in service and go to land of Canaan. Or he might have wished for the prophet Jacob to be buried in Egypt as an honor and a merit. Maybe Pharaoh would have said, okay, you have this great, illustrious father who died here. Let's bury him here. We'll build him a pyramid. And we'll make a shrine. Jacob is buried here. And what would Yosef have to do? Nobody had to comply. He had no choice. So therefore, Jacob adjured Joseph so that Pharaoh would feel it was improper to make Joseph violate his oath. So therefore, he made him swear, because he knew that Yosef didn't have the ultimate power to make this decision. That no matter how powerful Yosef and how influential Yosef was, he still knew that he was in a second place, that the power could be stripped away from him. Now, that doesn't mean because of anti-Semitism or the hatred of the Jews, but it does recognize and respect the fact that Yaakov and Yosef never ran away with their own self-importance. And that's another lesson in this story. And that kind of the lessons of security could sometimes be deceiving and give us a false sense of security because of the authority and the power we think that we have accrued over time, when really underneath it is a very weak foundation, or not as strong as we think. And it changes. And it changes. And how do I know it changes? Because if you take a look a little later on, in this parsha, there is no more story in the parsha of Vayechi of Yosef and Paro. Nothing. Interesting. After all what Yosef had done for Paro and for Egypt, there isn't even a slight reference to the relationship that Paro had with Yosef or Yosef had with Egypt. Now, you could say omission is not a proof of reality. It could be there was, and it just wasn't. We know the Torah has lots of verses that are not included. But Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was a student of Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, he points out that this is already a little bit harsh, okay? But you have to know Rav Yisraeli, and you have to know who he was. He was Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Arav. He was a close student of Rav Cook. He was one of the great religious Zionist thinkers of the 50s, 60s, 70s, until he got a little older in the 80s and passed away. And what he said, something really very interesting, is he said that Yosef was a utilitarian leader. He was only viable as long as he had a utility. And as soon as his utility declined, his leadership declined as well. And in fact, the reality is that in the Parsha Vayechi, the minimizing of his stature by not recording any exchange actually reflected who he was as an influencer in Mitzrayim. It's hard to prove it, because you don't know if the Pusik was there, just didn't say anything, but it certainly, he picks up on that same thing. Without mentioning any of these Rambans and Rashis that we saw. And which brings me to the last...
Don't you think that the Egyptian thought had requirement for Jacob to leave the land and bury it in another country? And also kind of...
Maybe. A little offensive.
You know, we bury our dead there, not here.
Right.
And there. And remember, they had a culture of extreme celebration of death.
Right.
And they made those gigantic, you know, extraordinary structures as a celebration of the death of important people. And here's somebody foregoing that. You know, be buried in some cave somewhere. Obviously, it's not the culture.
Right.
I think
it's a very valid point, man. Very valid point. And maybe that's why he made him swear, because he said, why would you take your father out? This is where he belongs. Take a look at verse 50:24, because I do want to end with an idea that I made up on my own. Maybe because we're running out of time, it's Hashem's way of saying, don't become too independent here with my own interpretation. So 50:24, if someone could just call out, it's Perek Nun.
88.
You're something else.
And you got 3.5 minutes, so you have plenty of time.
Yeah, right.
Stop.
I don't think I'll get there.
Stop the clock.
Stop the clock, right. What page did you say?
288.
Okay, 288. So, but you all take a look how this ends. Almost, we're going to do this really quickly. It's verse 24. So now we'll go through the same exact exercise with Yosef. Vayomer Yosef el Achav, Anochi met. I'm going to die. Ve'Elohim pakod yifkod etchem, and God will redeem us. Ve'elatchem min ha'aretz hazot, el ha'aretz shenishba'al Avraham Yaakov. Vayash by Yosef ebnei Yisrael pakod yifkod olhim etchem, balitim. That's what time he's there. So Yosef goes to the same exercise, says, swear to me that you take him out. But he uses the word pakod yifkod etchem. And why is that so important? Now go to 13:19 in Shmot. Because if you go to 13:19 in Shmot, you're going to see the code word. The code word, what he used over here, page 366. I think I beat Dr. Freeman to it. Page 366. Vayikach Moshe et atzmot Yosef imo, ki ashbea hishbia et bnei Yisrael leimor, pakod yifkod Elohim etchem. God will redeem us, valitim et atzmotayim yizeh. So Moshe, he fulfills the promise, and he takes Yosef's bones with him, and he brings them back to Canaan. Okay, well, it brings back to Israel. Let's take a look at Rashi. He had strongly adjured. Why did Yosef make everybody swear? He had made them swear because they would... why did he not make his son swear that they would take him to the land of Canaan? Skip the question. Joseph said, I was the ruler in Egypt and I had sufficient power to do what I followed desired. But my sons, the Egyptians, will not permit them to do this. He already knew that there was no way that he would have that power, would be inherited to the next generation. It just wouldn't be something that they can acquire by genetics. He achieved it, he acquired it, and it was lost. Consequently, he made them swear that when they would be delivered, he would go forth from there, they would take him. But Yosef knew his whole life that this was situational and episodic, and that it would never be anything that would amount to real Jewish control and power in a foreign land. So I just want to add but one last piece to it, which I say with a bit of equivocation, somewhat hesitation. I have 1 minute left, right? Or is it because uh-huh. 1 minute? If you look at the beginning of Shmot, I'm saying it very quickly. Now go to the first verse in Shmot. First verse in Shmot. Somebody want to give me the page? If you get it first, you get 1,000 points. 292. Vayamat Yosef. Take a look at verse 6, and then we're finishing. Vayamat Yosef. Page 292, verse 6. Vayamat Yosef v'chol echav v'chol adorahu uvnei Yisrael paru v'yishritzu v'yirbu v'yatz mod mod v'ti malei aretzotam. Anybody see where this is going? They became multiplied, strong, powerful, mighty, and v'ti malei aretzotam. They left Goshen, and they felt that Egypt was our home. We can acquire any piece of real estate wherever we want because we have the safety of our history. Yosef was the second to the king. And the minute that they batim al eretz otam b'yakim el chadash, there's a whole new attitude because the attitude reflected their attitude and that they missed, they couldn't see the handwriting on the wall. And that, I have to stop.
Well,
that's
cool. Thank you very, very much. Maybe we'll just sign you up in February.
I only know one Bartoro, though.